Before I arose from bed the second morning after Thanksgiving this year and engaged me in a meditation on their implications, the adjective meek is defined in the dictionary as manifesting patience and long-suffering, enduring injury without resentment, deficient in spirit and courage, submissive, not violent or strong, gentle, moderate, weak. You'll find such definitions there. Now, used as a collective noun, as in the statement I just opened with, meek refers to people who exhibit the qualities of patience in hardship and suffering, submissiveness under oppression and tyranny, humility. These meek are understood to be the poor, the afflicted, the weak, the oppressed. As I contemplated these meanings, I saw this Old Testament declaration as heralding the unprecedented possibilities of the covenant of Baha'u'llah. Thinking about it deepened my appreciation of the dispensation of Baha'u'llah, which clearly brings fulfillment of the promise assured to the meek of the earth. Remember when Baha'u'llah wrote to these leaders, these kings and rulers, giving them actually the key to resolving the problems of the world, and how they reacted or did not react at all? And he said that since they had refused the most great peace, they would have to settle for the lesser peace. And then later on we discovered that he turned over the business of reordering the affairs of mankind to the people. Later on, the kings can come back. A fact about this Old Testament statement is that it was surely inspired. It was an inspired assertion, for it was later endorsed by Jesus Christ in his Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the meek, Jesus affirmed, for they shall inherit the earth. From the beginning of recorded history until the appearance of Baha'u'llah in the 19th century, nations, for the most part, blithely disregarded the afflictions of the poor and weak that constituted the bulk of their populations. At the time of Baha'u'llah's ministry, the world was largely divided up among a few imperial powers. Most of them lived in small nations, England, Belgium, you know, small places, Portugal, Spain, but they divided up the world. And the vast majority of their subjects were the victims of injustice, a condition which they endured patiently, often with only a prayer and a hope for a better day. To mention just one of these powers, the British Empire alone occupied 1/4 of the planet, in which as much as 1/3 of the world's population lived. Isn't that an amazing thing? This little island had such force. What have we seen since the opening of the new age of Baha'u'llah? We have witnessed, and are still witnessing, a social, thank you, and political evolution, revolutionary in its suddenness and force, which proceeds in a manner and on a scale not experienced before. Among the significant developments that took place in less than a century after the ascension of Baha'u'llah, three are particularly relevant in this context. One, the fall of mighty dynasties. The establishment of independent nations by formerly colonized peoples. Three, a rapid rise in global awareness of many forms of injustice afflicting peoples and the consequent multiplication of organized remedial efforts. These days, we hear frequently of non-governmental organizations concerned with a variety of social ills. The Baha'i international community, for one, has emerged as one of the foremost non-governmental organizations in the world. I don't know if you know that, but that's a fact. Now, the speed of these developments is an historic phenomenon that can be fully appreciated only by those who recognize Baha'u'llah. The statement from Psalm 37, as already cited, is extracted from verse 11, which says in full, "But the meek shall inherit the earth and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace." From a Baha'i perspective, it is not difficult to arrive at a fairly good understanding of this whole verse and its future implications concerning the abundance of peace. The verse is shaped as it appears in this psalm. It's thought-provoking, especially in the light of Baha'u'llah's revelation. It is concerned with, that is, the whole psalm is concerned with the spiritual and social effects of the greed, corruption, and pride of the rich, of their evil deeds, which among other consequences exploit and oppress the poor. It exhorts all affected by such evils not to react with anger, jealousy, and vengeance, through which relief, but rather to trust in God, through which relief will eventually come. Evildoers will be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herbs, while faith in God will ensure for the poor the inheritance of the earth and the abundance of peace. I was curious as to how theologians might interpret all of this. So I dug into a couple of reference works, more than a couple. One of them, the New Interpreter's Bible, the other, the Expositor's Bible Commentary, and I found some rather interesting things there. But one of my findings will suffice. I'll just mention it. One of these books says, "The inheritance of the land refers to Canaan." That's a verse there that talks about a line that talks about the inheritance of the land. Then it goes on to say, "But the promise of God extends to all God's people and to the whole earth, as Jesus made clear in the Sermon on the Mount." And then there is, among the references given to back up these points, Isaiah is cited. Now, as you know, the prophecies of Isaiah about world peace are of particular relevance to the dispensation of Baha'u'llah, who, of course, announced the advent of a new world order. Shoghi Effendi affirmed in a letter to the American Baha'is that Isaiah foreshadowed the establishment of the lesser peace, as foretold by Baha'u'llah. This is his statement on page 33 of Citadel of Faith. It says, "It," meaning the lesser peace, "must in the end culminate in the unfurling of the banner of the most great peace in the golden age of the dispensation of Baha'u'llah." So that was quite a reach that Isaiah had in his sayings. Now, to understand the wondrous system, and I use this term from the Kitab-i Aqdas, the wondrous system Baha'u'llah announces in the Kitab-i Aqdas, is to appreciate the means by which the meek are to inherit the earth. For the system promises to be a global structure of unity. With the coming of Baha'u'llah, divine processes were set in motion, which clearly are changing the conduct of human affairs in all regions and at all levels. For anyone of us interested in gaining a proper perspective of these processes or in supporting efforts to improve the lot of the human race, serious attention must be given to the essentials of the administrative order of Baha'u'llah. It is obvious to any knowledgeable Baha'i that what the world needs are the principles and practices of Baha'i administration. We must find ways of making the viability, the efficacy of such principles evident in our own lives and in our efforts, so that others may benefit from their salutary effects and be prompted to emulate them. In the world order of Baha'u'llah, the management of human affairs is not exclusive to those who rule, but is a necessary responsibility which all share, in which all can play a vital role. In other words, every member of the Baha'i community is a part of the administrative order. It's not just a matter that rests with the elected bodies. Indeed, how else will the suffering masses be able to claim their inheritance if not by participating in an orderly attention to the matters that affect their lives? The Baha'i administration is indeed the ultimate means of their empowerment. It is no wonder then that Shoghi Effendi exhorted us to master the essentials of Baha'i administration. This was not simply so that we could manage the affairs of the Baha'i community, necessary as that is. It was more profoundly so that we might create the nucleus and set the pattern for the new world order that Baha'u'llah has offered as his revolutionizing legacy to all the peoples of the planet. Now, the Rabbani Trust, I understand, is primarily concerned with advancing social and economic development. For a Baha'i, the principles of Baha'i administration are of critical importance to success in this field. Let me invite you then to a brief review of certain concepts of Baha'i administration. This to encourage efforts not only to practice these principles, but also to seize every opportunity to impart them to others. Such imparting is in itself a service to those who are engaged in this work, and even more, a service to the world. In other words, what I'm saying is that getting across these principles and an understanding of them to others is social and economic development. Now, about the administration. The world order of Baha'u'llah, as you know, was foreshadowed in the writings of the Bab, his forerunner. The Persian Bayan, the mother book of his dispensation, in this book, the Bab explicitly refers to it. He says this, "Well is it with him who fixeth his gaze upon the order of Baha'u'llah and rendereth thanks unto his Lord." The Bab wrote this. Now, in announcing the earth-shaking effects of that order, Baha'u'llah in the Kitab-i Aqdas, the mother book of his dispensation, asserts the following. "The world's equilibrium hath been upset through the vibrating influence of this most great, this new world order. Mankind's ordered life hath been revolutionized through the agency of this unique, this wondrous system the like of which mortal eyes have never witnessed. Baha'u'llah's announcement of a new world order marks the fruition of a purpose that has been evolving since the beginning of human life. World order is an object of human aspirations to which philosophers, poets, and other enlightened thinkers, not to mention the prophets themselves, have given thought from the antiquity, at least from the antiquity of Greece to modern times. The idea has grown with the stages of human development. It has expressed itself in the framework of each of these stages as the sphere of human collective life expanded: family, tribe, city-state, nation-state. These, the circles of unity in the collective conduct and social interaction of humanity, have thus gradually been widened. These stages represent milestones in the evolution of human society. So as we got from, say, family collectivity to the tribal one, we were really building, putting on, establishing the building blocks of the new world order, which was in the distant future. The effort from time to time to form leagues and federations, whether of city-states or nation-states, oh yes, back in ancient Grecian times, they did have federation of Grecian states, as we talk about federation of states now. Now, this effort has demonstrated through the ages the urge of the race to achieve political unity as a matter of necessity, if for no other reason. But spiritual unity, as a principle of life transcending mere politics, has ever been promulgated by the divine prophets. By ignoring this principle too often, humanity has suffered disastrous consequences. Fortunately, we live in a day of renewal, the time of a fresh outpouring of divine grace. The newness, or I should say, the nowness, that is the timeliness, the nowness of bringing about a new world order, this most exalted goal of human development, is verified by Baha'u'llah in many passages of his writings. Among them is this arresting assertion. I get goosebumps every time I read it, and I've recited it to myself 1,000 times. He says, listen to this carefully, "The purpose underlying all creation is the revelation of this most sublime, this most holy day. The day known as the day of God in his books and scripture. The day which all the prophets and the chosen ones and the holy ones have wished to witness." Friends, this is the day in which we live. It's an amazing thought. So, indeed, this is the time. The social progress of the human race, marked by the stages of its development, from the birth of family life to the emergence of the nation state, has at last reached that stage when it must mature and attain its fruition in a global order. The driving, the operating principle of this ultimate goal is identified by Baha'u'llah as the oneness of humankind. This signals the coming of age of the entire human race. In other words, the object of the revelation of Baha'u'llah is to make the unity of the human race a global reality, a reality that is comprehensive, pervasive, and all-encompassing. This is a matter that affects both the transformation of our inner selves and the expression of our outer conduct. Clearly then, the long period of human social evolution has arrived at its final and most glorious stage. Shoghi Effendi, the guardian of the cause of Baha'u'llah and the appointed interpreter of his writings, interprets the meaning of this principle of the oneness of mankind in unmistakable terms. The following example will suffice. He writes in World Order of Baha'u'llah, right about page 41 or thereabouts, you'll find it. He says, let there be no mistake. The principle of the oneness of mankind, the pivot around which all the teachings of Baha'u'llah revolve, is no mere outburst of ignorant emotionalism or an expression of vague and pious hope. Its appeal, he says, is not to be merely identified with a reawakening of the spirit of brotherhood and goodwill among men. It's that, but it's far more than that. Its implications, he says, are deeper. Its claims greater than any which the prophets of old were allowed to advance. Now listen, its message, he says, is applicable not only to the individual, but concerns itself primarily with the nature of those essential relationships that must bind all the states and nations as members of one human family. Now, friends, we have difficulty binding our family in one. You know how it is these days. But nations and states are to act as one human family? Think of this. He says it does not constitute merely the enunciation of an ideal, but stands inseparably associated with an institution adequate to embody its truth, demonstrate its validity, and perpetuate its influence. I've been wondering what this institution might be. Now comes, I think, the statement that is sort of the centerpiece of this whole explanation. He says, it implies an organic change in the structure of present-day society, a change such as the world has not yet experienced. Big stuff. So, sitting in our chairs today, no matter for how long we've been Baha'is, we don't quite know what he's talking about yet. We have never experienced it. He tells us that it calls for no less than the reconstruction of and the demilitarization of the whole civilized world, a world organically unified in all the essential aspects of its life, its political machinery, its spiritual aspiration, its trade and finance, its script and language, and yet infinite in the diversity of the national characteristics of its federated units. In other words, we believe in preserving unity in diversity. So it's not to be a monolithic state where everybody is doing the same thing at 10 o'clock in the morning. Now, this challenge of social and political transformation has struck a growing number of thinkers. One of them has this to say. Listen to this. The one thing we can be sure of is that the world that will emerge from the present rearrangement of values, beliefs, social and economic structures, of political concepts and systems, indeed, of worldviews, will be different from anything anyone today imagines. In some areas, and especially in society and its structure, basic shifts have already happened, that the new society will be both a non-socialist and post-capitalist society is practically certain. And it is certain also that its primary resources will be knowledge. This also means that it will be a society of organizations. Certain it is that in politics we have already shifted from the 400 years of the sovereign nation state to a pluralism in which the nation state will be one rather than the only unit of political integration. Isn't that an interesting thought coming from a non-Baha'i? This is a man named Peter Drucker, who has written some rather marvelous books about the state of things in the world. Now, getting back to Sholeh Effendi, he tells us about this principle of the one oneness of mankind. He says it represents the consummation of human evolution. There is a huge idea for you. And it will happen. It must happen inevitably. Now, Sholeh Effendi has greatly expanded our understanding of the magnitude of Baha'u'llah's call for the unity of the human race as the will of God for this age. Baha'u'llah says this: "It beseemeth all men in this day to take firm hold on the Most Great Name and to establish the unity of mankind. There is no place to flee to, no refuge that anyone can seek except him." Now, Sholeh Effendi illuminates our understanding of this assertion in his writings as follows. And this is, to me, one of the greatest paragraphs ever written. Listen to this. I'll read it slowly. He says, "The revelation of Baha'u'llah, whose supreme mission is none other but the achievement of this organic and spiritual unity of the whole body of nations, should, if we be faithful to its implications, be regarded as signalizing through its advent the coming of age of the entire human race." So just one thought: the coming of age of the entire human race. Now, listen to this. "It should be viewed not merely as yet another spiritual revival in the ever-changing fortunes of mankind, not only as a further stage in a chain of progressive revelations, nor even as the culmination of one of a series of recurrent prophetic cycles." No. "But rather as marking the last and highest stage in the stupendous evolution of man's collective life on this planet." Have you soaked that in? Marking the last and highest stage in the stupendous evolution of man's collective life on this planet. Think about it. He goes on. "The emergence of a world community, the consciousness of world citizenship, the founding of a world civilization and culture, all of which must synchronize with the initial stages and the unfoldment of the golden age of the Baha'i era." All of these, world community and so on. He says they should by their very nature be regarded, as far as this planetary life is concerned, as, and listen to this now, the furthermost limits in the organization of human society. So we have three things, three explosive ideas here: the coming of age of the entire human race. The highest stage, the last and highest stage in the evolution of man's collective life on this planet. And attaining the furthermost limits in the organization of human society. Now, friends, you need an expanded awareness to take all of this in. Now, with all of that, our coming of age, in other words, if you think of the human being from fetus to infancy to childhood to adolescence to adulthood, he's talking about the adulthood of the human race. All of this evolution was to bring us to this stage. And it's not the end, he says. Though man as an individual must indeed as a result of such a consummation continue indefinitely to progress and develop. When you become an adult, you don't stop developing. In fact, you become mature. You're able to make use of all the things you've learned. You're creative. You can do things that you couldn't possibly have done when you were younger. So that's where the world is going. That's where humanity as a whole is going. That's where politics is going. That's where everything is going. To this highly mature stage. Now, this is heavy stuff. Joke 3. Give me a chance to breathe for a minute. So now, friends, the real question is, by what spiritual and practical means can so awesome an outcome be realized? Because it is awesome. That's a word that the youth use a lot these days, and it's a proper use here. Awesome. How, in fact, will the New World Order come about? This, the Baha'i writings tell us, will involve the workings of two simultaneous processes initiated by the revelation of Baha'u'llah. One is directly related to the administrative order he has ordained. Its course has been set, as Shoghi Effendi explains, by what he says, the revelation is the revelation of those stupendous tablets constituting the charter of Abdu'l-Bahá's divine plan. So one course is set and involves us as Baha'is. He says that it will be consummated through the emergence of the Baha'i World Commonwealth and the golden age of the Baha'i dispensation. If you want a reference for all of this stuff, go to Citadel of Faith. There is a letter there entitled Challenging Requirements of the Present Hour. Go up to page 30. Start reading from page 30 to 38. It will blow your mind. Now, this process involves the followers of Baha'u'llah directly, and those in North America particularly. We seem to forget this these days. So that's one process. The other process is destined, as the Guardian says, to lead through a process of victories and reverses to the political unification of the Eastern and Western hemispheres, to the emergence of a world government and the establishment of the lesser peace, as foretold by Baha'u'llah and foreshadowed by the prophet Isaiah. But this lesser peace will not come about through direct action of the Baha'is, but will involve the American people and government particularly. So this is what Baha'u'llah left to the rulers and leaders to bring about the lesser peace. That's what we're talking about here as a second process. And we have no direct responsibility for it, but we do have some indirect responsibility. You know, the Baha'u'llah tells the House of Justice that it must promote the lesser peace. And the House of Justice is trying its best. As you know, it put out this statement, the promise of world peace, remember? That's one of its efforts. Okay. Now, this lesser peace, then, Shoghi Effendi tells us, must, in the end, culminate in the unfurling of the banner of the most great peace in the golden age of the dispensation of Baha'u'llah. So you see these two parallel tracks are running. The one on which the Baha'is have been set and the one on which the world leaders have been set, and they will. These two processes relating to the lesser peace and the most great peace indicate a division of labor, as I call it, so to speak, the results of which are destined to merge. In one respect, this labor engages the rulers of nations who, with any direct action of the Baha'is, organize a world government, a purely political necessity compelled by world conditions. In the other respect, it employs the efforts of the followers of Baha'u'llah in two ways. In spreading the new teachings so as to effect a spiritual transformation in the character of individuals throughout the planet, and in raising up the institutions of the administrative order of Baha'u'llah, which is to serve as the nucleus and pattern of the new world order forecast by him. Now, the ultimate merging of these two essential processes will, in a sense, involve the effects of a chrysalis from which the new world order will come forth. You know what I mean by chrysalis? As you know, the chrysalis is the ultimate stage in the life form of a caterpillar and the initial stage in the shaping of life of a butterfly. Ordinarily, one does not discern the butterfly in the caterpillar. The activities of the two are so dissimilar. One creeps, the other flies, has wings. One sees even less by looking at the chrysalis. You know, it's a sort of hard thing sitting there, which assumes a dormant, apparently lifeless state. It hides the great transformation occurring within. Then one day, a creature of exquisite beauty bursts forth. The organic change resulting from this metamorphosis suggests the nature of what, at a totally different spiritual and social level, can be expected with regard to the establishment of the new world order by which the most great peace will be sustained in the golden age of the Baha'i dispensation. So you got my little metaphor or simile there. I'm thinking that if I don't know what the new world order is, it must be that we are going through the experience, the caterpillar stage now, and that we will go through the chrysalis, which will combine these two processes, and at the end will come this thing that we have not yet experienced, which will be new and different and beautiful and extraordinary. Now, the Baha'i writings speak of an administrative order and a new world order. How should they be perceived? That's a question. We must, first of all, bear in mind that the administrative order and the new world order, though closely related concepts, are not one and the same thing. The administrative order is a divinely ordained agency that is indispensable to the emergence of the new world order. A new world order will be the fruit of what both the Baha'i community and nation states do to bring about world unity. This is not a matter, really, that we can fully comprehend at this time. Commenting on the goal of a new world order, Shoghi Effendi writes, he says, to claim to have grasped all the implications of Baha'u'llah's prodigious scheme for worldwide human solidarity, or to have fathomed its import, would be presumptuous on the part of even the declared supporters of his faith. To attempt to visualize in all its possibilities, to estimate its future benefits, to picture its glory, would be premature at even so advanced a stage in the evolution of mankind. So, we really cannot fully picture what a united world would be like, with everybody behaving well, loving each other, helping each other, you know, having a world government, nation states that behave like families. My God, imagine that. I mean, if you look at the activities of our own government these days, you cannot have any hope of that. But Baha'u'llah says it's going to happen. As to the administrative order itself, what we do know of it is that it is the structure of unity designed by Baha'u'llah to canalize the creative and constructive forces released by his revelation. It enables society to tap the benefits, transformative influences flowing from that revelation, which are modernizing human life. Modernizing human life. Divine revelation is, of course, the mainspring of modernity in any age. People don't know this, but it's a fact. The system of Baha'u'llah combines the spiritual and practical requirements of life in a union that ensures the integrity of our actions and the soundness of our progress. This is so because the system is founded on the principles of unity and justice. Unity of the human race is the social, political, as well as spiritual expression of love. Justice is its mainstay. As Baha'u'llah has said, the light of men is justice. The purpose of justice is the appearance of unity among men. Isn't that a marvelous statement? What we may well ask is the nature of this justice that guarantees such a purpose. If we turn to Shoghi Effendi's masterpiece, The Advent of Divine Justice, we will find an illuminating discussion of it. That is, of justice within the rubric of rectitude of conduct. Remember this prerequisites: rectitude of conduct, chaste and holy life, freedom from prejudice? All right, rectitude of conduct is big on justice. In fact, he says it implies what? Justice, equity, honesty, truthfulness, fair-mindedness, trustworthiness, reliability. That's the stuff we're talking about. And he goes on to quote from Baha'u'llah that if we behave in these ways, the effects of the behavior of an individual affects the entire world. Amazing statements you'll find there as to the virtue, the sheer power of individual acts And Baha'u'llah has asked us, he says, the one thing he asks us is to be just and fair-minded. It is on this foundation of unity and justice that world peace is assured, on which a world civilization is being raised up as a reflection on earth of the kingdom of heaven so long anticipated in the prayer of Jesus Christ. So then, friends, when we study and apply the principles of the administrative order, we are attending to what it means to live successfully in the modern age, what it means to establish the kingdom of God on earth, which Baha'u'llah, the promised one of all ages, has come to accomplish. It is by applying these principles that the meek can realize their inheritance of the earth, as proclaimed in the Sermon on the Mount. That we who follow him have become participants in so exalted an effort indicates the magnitude of the privilege that is ours and that is possible to all who turn to him. Truly, it is a privilege that is inestimable. So you still ask, why a Baha'i administrative order? Shoghi Effendi gives us an answer in World Order of Baha'u'llah on page 19. He gives us many answers, but here's one of them that you might like to contemplate now. He says, few will fail to recognize that the spirit breathed by Baha'u'llah upon the world and which is manifesting itself with varying degrees of intensity through the efforts consciously displayed by his avowed supporters and indirectly through certain humanitarian organizations. Now, friends, this force that Baha'u'llah has released doesn't belong just to us who believe in him. It influences everything, everything. And the garden is mentioning here, working through the efforts of the Baha'is and the efforts of those engaged in humanitarian organizations. So when he wrote this way back in the early 30s, how many NGOs did we have in the world? You see what has happened? The efflorescence of NGOs, that we can't count them anymore. All concerned with a lot of human beings. You see how Baha'u'llah is working? So if we don't do our tasks, he's not waiting for us. Bear this in mind. He's not waiting. So, to go back to this, few will fail to recognize that the spirit breathed by Baha'u'llah upon the world and which is manifesting itself with varying degrees of intensity through the efforts consciously displayed by his avowed supporters and indirectly through certain humanitarian organizations can never permeate and exercise an abiding influence upon mankind unless and until it incarnates itself in a visible order, which would bear his name, wholly identify itself with his principles, and function in conformity with his laws. So if we don't have this order identified with Baha'u'llah, which prompts us to behave in accordance with the principles he has ordained and the laws he has ordained, nothing will happen. That reminds me that Shoghi Effendi said, this is a sort of stray point, that without the study and application of the administration, the teaching of the cause becomes not only meaningless, but loses in effectiveness and scope. This is pretty heavy stuff. So those people who say, I love Baha'u'llah, but I can't stand the administration, they're walking on the wrong side of the street. So what guarantees do we have of the effectiveness and security of the administrative order? Well, Shoghi Effendi explains it to us again. World Order of Baha'u'llah, page 145. This is what he says. It should be noted in this connection that this administrative order is fundamentally different from anything that any prophet has previously established, inasmuch as Baha'u'llah has himself revealed its principles, established its institutions, appointed the person to interpret his word, and conferred the necessary authority on the body designed to supplement and apply his legislative ordinances. So Baha'u'llah has not left anything to chance. He gave us laws, institutions, interpreter, so we can't misunderstand his intentions, and an exemplar who shows us how to behave. The Guardian goes on to say, therein lies the secret of its strength, its fundamental distinction, and the guarantee against disintegration and schism. So this administrative order is the tent of humanity. Anything that gathers under that tent is safe and secure. All of the activities that we conduct in this world must be under the shadow of that tent, including the things you're concerned about in social and economic development. Now, here is a point that drives home the significance of the administration, and this made in World Order of Baha'u'llah on page 5. You know, there were people who were complaining at the time that the Guardian took over his work that he was fiddling with structures. He wasn't really promoting the love that Abdu'l-Bahá had exhibited in the world. So listen to this. He says it should be remembered by every follower of the cause that the system of Baha'i administration is not an innovation imposed arbitrarily upon the Baha'is of the world since the master's passing. He says that it derives its authority from the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, is specifically prescribed in unnumbered tablets, and rests in some of its essential features upon the explicit provisions of the Kitab-i-Aqdas, which is our mother book. He goes on to say it thus unifies and correlates the principles separately laid down by Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá. In other words, the administrative order incorporates these principles, unifies them, and is indissolubly bound with the essential verities of the faith. Then he tells us this, and listen closely. To dissociate the administrative principles of the cause from the purely spiritual and humanitarian teachings would be tantamount to what? A mutilation of the body of the cause. A separation that can only result in the disintegration of its component parts and the extinction of the faith itself. So you separate out administration and you've got disaster. Joke one. So we return to the question, is the Baha'i administrative order to be realized? Okay. The reality and benefits of such an order can be realized only if we recognize our contractual arrangement with Baha'u'llah. I use that word advisedly, our contractual arrangement with Baha'u'llah. And then, by endeavoring to fulfill our part of the contract. Remember, hidden words? See? Maybe I'm drying out up here, am I? You see? By recognizing our contractual arrangement, and then by endeavoring to fulfill our part. Remember this from the hidden words. Love me that I may love thee. If thou lovest me not, my love can in no wise reach thee. This is the whole expression of the covenant, friends, in my view anyhow. At the very heart, then, of this contract is the covenant of Baha'u'llah. I'm going to stop right here. Now, there's a second part to this thing, and the second part will complete the whole argument that I've put before you.